Welcome to FO Podcasts. With me is an old friend, Flavius. Flavius has just come back from Ukraine. He was there to understand the role of religion in the conflict and to make sense of the role religion plays in Ukrainian society today. Thank you, Flavius, for making the time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Flavius, you've been to Ukraine. You've seen a fair bit. I have a very simple question to kick off our conversation. What is the public mood and what is the public morale in the country today?
Yes. So as a general introduction and caveat, I went to Ukraine. I visited Ukraine for nearly a month to look at a largely overlooked story, but very crucial, that revolves around understanding the role religions play in the conflict, and purposefully try to stay away from military or political issues because they are sensitive and that was not within the scope. However,
and you don't want to be an outcast in Washington, D.C.
That you have been too long in Washington, D.C. You know that very well as well. Exactly. It's very polarized, like everything is polarized here in the Beltway. But in doing those scores of interviews, of course, these issues of Ukraine, the future of Ukraine and the mood came up. I can say that all the people, the everyday Ukrainian citizen that I met, told me that they want to keep fighting. Some have recrimination in terms of the military support that the West provided,
which they think is simply not enough.
Not enough. And also, what was interesting, with delays. Why did you wait so long to approve the Leopard tank, for example, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of that the military aid was provided with a hand behind the tied behind the back. And that's a bit surprising.
So there's a sense of betrayal amongst the Ukrainians.
There is a sense of let down, but there is also a sense that we cannot continue without the West. Like it's a day and night. If you don't continue supporting us, there is no prospect to
understood. And so the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, is unlikely to be a very popular figure in Ukraine right now.
Not right now, and let's see how the Republican rebellion with his rank will determine whether he can actually push that $60 billion package or not in the near future, but that's for another conversation.
That's another conversation. Let's talk about what is the current shape of Ukraine 2 years after the February 24th, 2022 Russian invasion? What does the country look like? Where did you travel? What did you find?
Yes. So also to provide a bit of context, I spent nearly a month. I visited multiple key cities, from Chernivtsi in the west near the border with Romania to Khmelnytsky, Kiev, obviously, and Odessa in the south. The western part of Ukraine, where I was, to a large extent, was shockingly, almost shockingly serene. If you drive through Kiev, there are few signs of the war. The theaters are open, the bus ride around town. I did, during my stay in Kiev, I was there when there was one missile attack, and you could hear the anti-missile missiles flying off, about four or five, and then the Russian missile hitting the ground because the ground shook, right? Which, in parenthesis, since you ask about military, it's a pretty dire ratio. If they send four or five anti-missiles, and even with that, the Russian missile hit the ground. But what I was being told and what I could witness to some extent is the everyday life of Ukrainians goes on, and the city, you know, has the appearance of a vibrant European city.
So Western Ukraine seems to be doing fine. You do not see the daily effects of the war, but I'm sure the closer you get to the front, Odessa must not be normal.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. It's not a war of annihilation that you witness, such as in Gaza, for example, which is a totally different story, right? And as you said, when you get closer to the front or to the part that had been under Russian occupation, like Bucha, you see the evidence, the destructions of the war, including on religious buildings. And that's definitely more of a very, it's a visual aspect that you are in a war and you have been fighting in those regions.
So you've mentioned religion, already. So let's get cracking. How has the conflict affected the church, and what is the role of the conflict, or what is the role of religion in this conflict?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because a less visible but equally important battle in today Ukraine is being waged between the country's religious communities and between the current state administration and the religious communities. And that state of affairs reveals the complex interface between not only faith, but also nationalism, the state power, and the war.
So give me a more precise answer. What does this mean? Does this mean that now the Orthodox Church in Ukraine is split in two? Is there one Orthodox Church that answers to the Patriarch in Moscow and another to, let's say, somebody in Ukraine, maybe the president? What exactly do you mean by this religious divide?
You're right. So you have today two competing churches in Ukraine. One that is the traditional one, and we'll come back to that about its
traditional
origins.
Traditional one meaning the head of the church is the Patriarch in Moscow.
The Patriarch in Kiev. And one has to take a step back historically to set the stage. The Ukraine, or Kiev, is actually the origin story of Orthodoxy in that part of the world.
Correct. That's where the Kingdom of Rus begins, in modern-day Ukraine, as per myth.
Exactly.
And perhaps history, too.
988, Prince Vladimir was baptized on the banks of the Dnieper, the main river that cut Ukraine in two parts, east and west. And that's the kickoff of Eastern Orthodoxy. So in fact, Ukraine is the mother of Eastern Church in that part of the world, a very proud heritage. That's the traditional Ukrainian church with its own patriarch in Kiev. And another data point, the Russian church was started later. It was an offshoot of that church, right?
It was an offshoot
of that church.
It became the dominant one because, of course, the Russian Empire was centered in Moscow, and of course, the Soviet Union was then in Moscow. And after the Soviet Union collapsed, the new Russian Republic that emerged very much championed the Orthodox Church in Moscow.
Right, and that's actually a very good point, and sometimes a bit overlooked fact that Russia is not the Soviet Union. It went from a very secular, aggressively secular ideology to a fairly conservative, traditional Christian values society.
Yeah. It was the return of Tsardom without the Tsar. You could argue Vladimir Putin is a modern Tsar.
On the political side, yes, but also on the everyday Russian life, religion has taken a role, a primary role in people's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a civil society and everyday Russian. And you see the same thing in Ukraine, right? You do have two separate administrative entities and more, if you look at Belarus, which each country having its own patriarch.
Mm.
Why it's important, the traditional Ukrainian church is very proud of that heritage. It's very proud of its nationalism, if you wish. The second church, which is more recent, its origin come from the independence of Ukraine in 1991, and in its current form was created by the previous president of Ukraine, Mr. Poroshenko.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a state-backed church, if you wish. And in the ramp-up to the war, with the hostilities in 2014 after Maidan, the new church, the state-supported church, which, just for our listener to know the terms, is the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, has been challenging the traditional church, accusing it of being pro-Russian, which obviously, as your listener can understand, it's a big thing.
It's a charge equivalent to treason.
It's a kiss of death in many respects. So the the state of affairs today is those two churches are competing. In fact, it's not so much of a competition. It's the newer state-backed church being sort of aggressively, you can say, appropriating the church properties and switching parishes from the traditional church, which the name is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, to that new leadership and administrative structure.
So there is a battle going on between Russia and Ukraine. There's a battle going on between the two churches for land, for dominance, and of course for souls. So we are back to the battle of souls, almost like the 16th century after 1517 and Martin Luther's 95 thesis, huh?
Yes, it's a good point. And just as then, you have in the mix political violence and political persecution and religious persecution that comes with throughout history. It's not a new phenomenon, as you described.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've already explained it a bit, but how is nationalism or patriotism related to the church? And what is the relation between the church and the state today?
Right. So now you have in Ukraine with vis-a-vis religious practices, two school of thoughts. One is the traditional church is controlled or has allegiance toward Moscow. And the other school of thought is that that's not the case. The traditional church has always maintained its independence and it's just as patriotic as the other church members. And indeed, during my visits and with the interview that I conducted with parishioners, but also civil society, government, you know, officials, and religious leaders, you could not see a lack of patriotism. You cannot see a lack of patriotism within the traditional Church of Ukraine. And I visited both churches. For example, in one parish, the head of the church showed me a Ukrainian flag with the signature of frontline soldiers in gratitude for the effort humanitarian.
This is the traditional
church, right? In another, during another visit, I was introduced to a woman who was in tears. Her son had died a couple of days ago. So what transpired is that on the front line, there is no distinctions. And the traditional church is providing the support it can, is providing the manpower, just like any other religious communities in Ukraine. And they're also dying and being involved in the fight, just like anyone else. And in the third parish, I saw a flag from a Ukrainian assault brigade. I don't exactly remember the name now. And again, that assault brigade had been thanking the parish for its support by sending their flag, essentially, with the appreciation.
So let me stop you. Just remind our listeners, what are the names of the two churches again? The traditional and the new state-backed church. Can you name them once again?
Yes, the traditional church is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And the newer church, state-backed church, is the Orthodox Church of Ukraine.
Okay. Very, very simple, right? They're actually quite confusing. Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. They've just swapped the word Ukraine around.
And that's a very good point. It makes it harder for us outside Ukraine to really understand what's happening. And it's also something we are not so used to in America, of having that we do have religion and state together in many respects.
I mean, look at the ruling on abortion. That is fundamentally because of religious belief.
Right. Absolutely. Yet institutionally, it's not really understandable for American to have a state sponsoring a particular religious institution, right? Or expropriation between religious communities. So yeah, these two churches can be confusing at times for good reason. But on the ground, the difference is very real.
Understood. So this brings me on to a very important point, since you've already mentioned religious conflict. Has religious freedom declined and has persecution increased as a result of the conflict?
Good question. The claim and the grievance of the members, the traditional church members, is that violence is being used against them to shut down their practice, to force them to switch their allegiance from the traditional to the New York church, but also to expropriate buildings. Mm. And
Well, that's an old game. After all, Henry VIII took away all the buildings and land of the Catholic Church and made himself the head of the Church of England.
Exactly.
And so this is a game that rulers and governments have played for a long time.
Absolutely. And in that case, it's not that the king or the president wants to divorce and marry, but in the context of the war. And the pretext, if you wish, or the claim is that the traditional church is tainted because it's aligning with Russia. To come back to your political violence, I did witness parishioners and churches that have been transferred. The parishioners told me violently that have been transferred from one administration to the other.
From the traditional church to the new state-backed church.
With the rules of how is that done, not particularly clear, and being subject to manipulation, from what I've witnessed. One aspect of the rule is the legal context. The administrative context is local parishes decide which affiliation they have based on a vote.
Mm-hmm. But is the vote clear and transparent?
Exactly.
Or is there stuffing of ballot boxes? Or perhaps there aren't even ballot boxes, and you say there was a vote, a fictional vote, and then you declare it's all done and dusted.
Exactly. And that's definitely seems to be a trend there. Especially a good proxy to answer your question is when you look at the attendance of the newer church, which is the traditional church building, but run by the newer church. Mm-hmm. In many, many, many visits, the traditional church building that had been taken over
by the
new church, there were no one there during the service or just a handful of people. However,
10 people and their dogs.
Exactly. And maybe not the dogs. And also outside, making sure, you know, the Russians are not coming too close. But, you know, it's a good point. On the other hand, the traditional church members, having nowhere to go, had settled into private houses, even barn, fighting the cold, the blistering cold as of Ukraine, the lack of space, the limitations. And the first church, relocated church that I visited near Chernivtsi, people had congregated in the barn. So the walls were made of wood and there was no central heating. It was packed, very cold, but people stood there and didn't want to let go of their traditions. They did, for them, the building didn't matter so much. What mattered was to keep their relationship with their priest. In the Eastern Orthodoxy, the church about the apostolic blessing, the apostolic tradition, which you have a direct lineage from blessing from one generation of priests to the other, which they consider is broken when you have the new church. So there is a very strong electrical current through the history of the church to today that they do not want to be dispossessed of. There's also another aspect with the new church. It has replaced the liturgy language from Slavonic to Ukrainian. What is Slavonic? Slavonic is roughly the equivalent of Latin. It's a proto-pre-Slavic language that is nowhere, they spoken nowhere, again like Latin. It gave birth to Ukrainian, to Russian, etc. But
it's the mother language. It's like Latin, very similar to
exactly.
Latin.
Exactly. That is the closest.
It's a medieval language.
It's a medieval language. Prince Vladimir started the church with the Slavonic. Mm-hmm. And in a way to distinguish itself from the traditional church, to maybe assert its nationalism, the language was replaced. And the language, again, is a tradition. Slavonic is a tradition. They don't see that as being pro-Russian or not. It's a tradition and a language that they associate with the liturgy.
Excellent, excellent. So we have this curious situation now that religious freedom, indeed, by your accounts, seems to have declined and persecution seems to have increased. It's not medieval, but it's certainly clear and evident. And so what roles are the big powers, the US, UK, France, etc., the United Nations, and the international civil society organizations playing in all of this?
Yes, so when we talk about religious persecution, it's not just us saying that. It's been mentioned and it's been expressed as a concern by the United Nations. There is an ongoing UN investigation, the human rights body of the UN, on this matter, and that has that has highlighted violence, persecution, expropriation of the church properties that we just reviewed a moment ago. And my sources within the UN mentioned that currently the investigation is not so much at the forefront of the UN work because of the conflict, but that the UN is still very much concerned and concerned that the recommendations and the solutions that they have advised Ukraine to take to prevent political violence, to address expropriation, have not been implemented by the country. So it's something that is known, and that is known since for many, many years, to 2016, I think is the first report. Again, so that's not me saying that, it's...
Understood. But given the conflict, they don't want to give too much of ammunition to perhaps the Russians and to weaken Ukrainian standing in the world.
Perhaps, but interestingly, even within that context you just mentioned, last December, late November, the UN issued another letter of concern. So that tells you that even in the context of being careful during the war, it is serious enough that the UN will nonetheless issue a letter of concern by the human rights rapporteur. You ask about the Western allies, the big power, the US and the UK. They have largely followed the narrative or of the government, which is there is no religious persecution. Perhaps the acronym do not help. They are so close, the two churches. But there is not really much interest to dig deeper. In the US, it's probably that tradition and of separation of state and church, perhaps, which in that case is a bit of an irony because there's a lack of separation of state and church in Ukraine that the US should be concerned about. But itself, the country doesn't mingle or it says so in religious issues, the lack of understanding of what's at stake, and simply following the government narrative is very powerful. It's around town and it's a settled issue for the US government. All right. The government tells us there is no religious persecution. So be it. Let's focus on the military. However, given that polarization and that fracture within the Ukrainian society around religious issues, it's obvious that it has an impact and implication on the conflict itself.
Yeah.
A divided society is not able to fight just as well as a united society, like in other countries here after 9/11, or you can even say Russia in the current war. So
very quickly, what you're saying is that the religious division is not good for the Ukrainian war effort because society is divided as of now on religious grounds.
Exactly, it is divided on religious ground. Harming the will to fight, although I have not witnessed that, but hypothetically you can say that it
will. Logically, can say that. If you notice that people are suddenly not in their own church, but they are attending worship in a barn, surely their faith in the state shakens.
Absolutely. At the very best, it's a distraction from their focus on the war and carrying the fight.
So let me interrupt you. So have U.S. investment policies worked?
U.S.
and Western policies worked,
right?
Then in this domain, I'm not
right.
talking of the broader context of Ukraine per se, but in this domain, have they worked?
As we touched upon, it's largely overlooked, except that the international organization, the UN, and a few others, but it's largely overlooked, and they follow, they adopt the viewpoints that the government is promoting, which is there is no religious persecution.
Okay.
This is an internal issue.
So they're putting their head like an ostrich in the sand.
Right, which is an interesting aspect as well on the prospect for the conflict. My parishioners that I met, the everyday Ukrainian citizen, were concerned that we're not helping by ignoring some of these issues, including religious corruption is another example, that we are not doing enough to earmark the
misappropriation of funds.
Exactly, and they would like to see an ombudsman. Also another kind of shocking fact is we don't have an ombudsman for the money that the US give away to Ukraine, allegedly on the basis that it would create too much delay, friction, and the Pentagon has its own operation. But the folks in Ukraine on the ground say, well, why don't you do your work? Like, you have to monitor the money because we know there is corruption. And
very interesting.
An interesting story in that context is over and over, every day Ukrainians show me or said that they were, and show me with Telegram accounts, evidence and others, that they had to provide some basic equipment and gears to the soldiers on the front line. From a helmet to bullets to jackets, and that's concerning for them because when they hear the government and when they hear about the aid coming from the West, it is presented as earmarked for, you know, X number of soldiers to be equipped, but in fact they have to provide this 20-30% directly, and they show me some evidence on Telegram where they are fundraising within their community to be able to send a jacket, to be able to send a helmet. And that's across religious communities, not any specific one.
So what you're telling me is that Western and in particular US authorities are turning a blind eye to a growing problem.
Absolutely. I think out of perhaps genuine concern that we don't want to add too much burden, too much delays on our aid to Ukraine. Also, in line with what the Ukrainian government says, that, look, I mean, we can manage our money.
But can they?
And that's the question. And there are definitely reasons for concern. And again, the recrimination I heard from Ukraine themselves is that you should do that. Like, why don't you do that? And I responded, well, your government says it's fine. I say, well, do you really believe it's fine? And we don't see the money, and that's another. You know,
what you're touching upon is a society that is divided not just religiously, but also a society that is fractured because of corruption. The people do not trust their elites.
That's certainly a plausible conclusion. What they are faced with is to step in.
Because of elite failure.
Because of the failure of the aid that is claimed to be alleged to be sent to the recipients and does not get there.
Yeah, this is a familiar problem. The US dumped in money in Afghanistan. People like Ashraf Ghani and before that, his predecessor. Hamid Karzai. Their administrations ran off with it. So the people in Kabul got fat, rich, and happy, whilst the rest of the country was starved of the money which was supposedly going for them.
And you could hope that we would learn our lessons in Washington, but it seems that in the Beltway we have short-term memory.
No, we have the memory of
goldfish.
Goldfish, the memory of a goldfish, or the attention span of a goldfish. All right. So, what are the prospects for reconciliation and for peace?
You'll be forgiven for having a bleak outlook on that prospect. One way of looking at the near future is newer state-backed church is on its own momentum as an interest group to gain more power, to acquire and more properties, a larger role, and with the allies of Ukraine ignoring the issue and the government telling the world that there's no problem. There is no reason to think that it's not going to continue on. And the traditional church will be increasingly more marginalized and the society more divided. There are ways to help reconcile these international platforms. For example, when the State Department invites delegates from Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, that is Washington speak. The State Department can do very little. The State Department can do exceedingly little in most parts of the world. Ultimately, it is the facts on the ground that determine whether you have religious tolerance and peace or not.
Right. Here it's interesting, right? Because it could help. It could start with hearing the voice of that church.
Understood.
That's where those platforms...
So you are saying that because the Ukrainian government is dependent on Western aid, if the State Department were to give weightage to the complaints of the traditional church, there are strong chances for a rapprochement or a peace.
A rapprochement, a peace, a dialogue, but also for Western allies of Ukraine to hear about that.
And to unify a fraction, or at least to bring more cohesion to a deeply divided society.
Right. And today, instead, you have these hypocritical claims from various platforms. Again, the State Department is one, or think tanks. They claim they are bringing together the religious community of Ukraine. And in fact, they're just acting mouthpiece for the state-run church. They it's not that they criticize the traditional church. They just ignore it and do not include them. So you again, I think a low-hanging fruit for us, ally of Ukraine, would be to bring to the conversation all religious communities and not simply the one that the government will handpick.
And we haven't even talked about the Hungarian minority, which is Catholic, or the Romanian minority, which is also Catholic. So we haven't even talked about the other churches within Ukraine.
Yeah, and it's actually a very inspiring when you I went to Ukraine through the Romanian-speaking part of Ukraine. And it's beautiful in a way, right, that when Ukraine is at its best, it is a sort of giant Switzerland. the ethnic Romanians that I met, they have no interest into going back to Romania. They want to stay. There is a compromise with the state. They have their school, but they are patriotic Ukrainians. So again, it has that capacity to bring those communities together, and it has done so. And I think our role is to help doing that, to help Ukraine be at its best.
Mm-hmm. But of course, those communities, if there is religious intolerance, might want to go back to their Hungaries and their Romanias and to the countries where they feel more secure. That is also the dark side of a Switzerland that goes wrong, corrupt, and divided.
Right. You can argue that when everyone can vote with raising hand, it's easier to run than a country the size of Ukraine. But I have not witnessed so, and that's not the purpose of my trip, witness the persecution or tensions between the different faith, like Catholic, Orthodox.
Understood.
Right now, as I witness, it's more of an internal Orthodox.
It's more of a civil war for the control of the Orthodox
Church.
Church,
which is, of course, the main. But you're absolutely right. There have been concern, maybe not so much that I know of, about religious persecution, but victimization of minorities and resistance to the draft, or to the certain issues around or of their victimizations, and the government needs to pay attention to keeping that unity. And you can argue that if the unity is compromised, if the government is willing to let the polarizations and the fracture within the Orthodox Church, it doesn't look good for the way it will handle relation between other religious communities, right, and the state church relation.
Brilliant. Now, Flavius, thank you so much for your time. You've been extremely busy. I know you've been working around the clock. So thank you for sparing a few minutes for us. Those of you who've been listening to us, make sure you follow FO Podcasts on Spotify, Apple, or whatever is your medium of choice. Of course, you can find us on our website, fairobserver.com, where, if you don't do so already, you must subscribe to our newsletters, which are free. From Flavius and me, it's bye for now.
Thank you.